So let's start. The moderator is not here, so I'm going to introduce myself. I'm Hubertus Franke from IBM Research in New York. This is a talk towards better memory management in hosted Linux systems. This is joint work with IBM Germany and IBM Systems Group, so various people from there. So what's the motivation and problem statement? I mean, the previous talk we already heard a little bit about system consolidation, that is, you would like to host multiple workloads on a single platform, that is obviously desirable because it increases resource utilization, because most servers today, whether they're print servers, file servers, and so on, they are typically not busy. There's been studies where show that certain servers, whether they're Windows or Linux servers, do not see an average utilization higher than 10 to 15%. So that basically allows us to squeeze more out of the system. It also allows us to reduce hardware cost. The system management cost reduction is evidenced, and finally, licensing fees can be reduced by only having one machine. But there are basically two directions that workloads can be consolidated. One is the virtual machines, which obviously had their origins in IBM 370 machines 30 years ago. And newer versions are VMware, Xen, and Linux on Z-Series on running on derivatives of the 370s. Here we basically host multiple independent operating systems or guest operating systems over the host. The plus points of those is that we have total isolations between the guest operating systems. It also gives us the ability to have operating system library version independence. That means in one guest OS I can run Red Hat, and another one SUSE, and so on and so on. The negative impact, of course, is that there's limited resource sharing, although there are facilities around in various environments, and one should expect there to be some overhead. The other direction is virtual servers. Examples are Sun Containers, vServer, OpenVZ. What they try to do, they virtualize with a single operating system using some form of OS isolation features. And, you know, the easiest one is a user, as we all know, it's isolated from each other. Here we basically have higher efficiency, we can share resources inside the OS, but of course we have limited fault isolation. That means when one of the OS's crashes, workloads basically crashes the OS, then the whole damn thing goes down. Secondly, you've got to all rely on the same operating system library versions, and that, again, is in many environments not useful. But they're both valid approaches. In this talk, I'm going to focus on virtual machines, and in particular on the memory management, and later we want to dive a little bit into the Z-Series architecture, which is the mainframe on which we implemented this. So if you look at why is memory so difficult, I mean, the way I try to explain it is CPU and I/O are renewable resources. Once I lose it, once I regain it, there's very little state and I can basically just continue if you forget about TLB misses and cache misses and so on. But in principle, your degradation is basically linear. So at that point, you can do quite fine-grained sharing in terms of time. When you look at memory, it actually maintains state. So intense sharing and switching between different users is very expensive. So we all know that when we have to switch too frequently, we get into threshing situations and, you know, the quote-unquote runs like a dog. Now, if you look at the virtual machine approaches that, for instance, Xen, Haiyan, and OpenVZ, and, you know, Xen and VMware use, they usually go into the order of tens of operating systems. Our target on the mainframe is thousands of virtual machines, and that's quite obvious, the mainframe cost a pretty penny, so you want to consolidate as much on it as you can. Folklore says basically that somebody once successfully booted and ran 42,000 Linux images on a single Linux system, so the system is capable of supporting that many images. Of course, they all run, as I said before, like a dog. Now, what we're trying to do here with in the order of thousands of virtual machines is to get a very high level of memory overcommitment. Obviously, on these large and large machines, memory is very expensive. We are talking about not 100 bucks per 1 gigabyte, we're talking about 1,000 and more. So the more as you can squeeze out of your memory, the better. When you have 1,000 virtual machines, by definition, the workload has to be on each of these guest operating systems, has to be bursty in nature. You have only 100% CPU. That means if you have to divide it up, you get 0.1% of the CPU. By definition, the workload has to be bursty. The second thing what we can observe is because they're bursty, the memory requirements of guests have to be time variant. That means at the time when you're running, you probably have to suck up a lot of memory, and by the time when you're idle, you basically lose most of it, or it's of no use to you. So to ask the question is, what is then the right method to share memory among many guest operating systems? So I'm going to run you through a little history and observation thing. So obviously you start out with the OS virtual memory VM overview, you know, OS 101 course. Don't want to go too different. You basically have applications that are, all of have a, the illusion of a virtual of a single system. They're basically virtualized already in the guest operating system. Each gets its process memory, the page cache and so on, basically hides the I/O to the file system. When you're running out of memory, you basically take some pages and basically swap them out, and on access you're going to be get swap them back in. So because of the time variance and the lack of you know, the delay that swapping causes, the OS goes to a great extent to figure out what are the hot pages that it should keep in memory and which should be thrown out or retained in the swap space. One of the things that keep on biting us is that the operating systems today uses every available memory that is not used by application for page caching. So if you give it memory, it most likely will use it. So the most simplest approach is memory partitioning. It basically has its origins from architectures like NUMA architectures 10 years ago, where you literally could cut off the memory bus or could partition the memory bus. And what happened is that the hypervisor system underneath simply said, okay, this guest operating system here is going to get that section of memory, and this operating system here gets that section of memory. The hardware was basically physically partitioned, and there was no way of basically causing faults across partitions. Today, it's done slightly different. We know if you look at Xen, they're using paravirtualization. Our AX system also uses paravirtualization. You basically take your page table, you write something to it, and then have the hype trap into the hypervisor and verify that you could actually establish a translation to that physical memory. And if not, that translation is rejected. Again, through the translation mechanism, you ensure that a fault isolation is maintained. So now let's take a look how memory has to be shared. If you look here, you basically have to identify, you know, how big do I want to make my guest operating system? But if memory utility and varies heavily, what I'm going to do about it? So let's presume I have, I want to establish what the utility of memory is. So I have, here's the number of pages I'm going to give to a guest operating system, and this is basically how the performance will go up with the number of memory that's given. And they're just different performance curves, so they have different utility. So if you take the black, the green and the red, and you just mirror it, you basically have a partition, and right at the intersection point, you have exactly what the optimal, at that point, optimal the partitioning of these two partitions are. And obviously, as the application changed their behavior, so will this optimal point change. So the idea then is, can I dynamically move pages from one partition to the other? And that's essentially what this dynamic memory partitioning does. So you have a resource manager, what I call a VM sizer, running inside the hypervisor, which tries to estimate how much memory should be given. And that can be done through various things. I mean, there's a classical paper by the VMware person, Walzberger, who basically went through how working set size estimation could be done. He basically does look at swap rates, fault rates, minor faults, sampling, all kinds of nonsense can be done there to say, okay, this one needs this much memory, and then you can basically calibrate with the two curves that I've shown before. The way that is actually implemented is through a ballooner. So the ballooner just sits as a driver in the operating system, and when I want to shrink the virtual memory that's given to the guest operating system, simply inflates. That means he allocates, takes the memory, gives it back to the hypervisor, and from there on will not touch it anymore. The same point, I'm just simply telling the balloon on the other end, hey, take a certain amount of pages that are privately given back to me and just give it back to the operating system. So you initially boot your operating system with the maximum size, inflate the ballooners, and then basically start migrating these, or basically sizing these ballooners over time. And that's actually a quite good approach in stable workloads with small number of guests, like in the case of Xen and VMware. And, you know, that's basically where it's deployed today. Xen, VMware, AIX, DLPAR all use this kind of technology. So The memory management in virtualized and host environment is slightly different. What we're going to do here is we basically have a full-fledged operating system underneath. And an example of this is, for instance, the ZVM hypervisor on the Z-Series, which is, you know, I don't know, 30, 40 years older basically than me. But it has evolved and it's you know, gotten a second wind for hypervising basically Linuxes on the mainframe. And it's a full-fledged operating system. Think of UML as well on Linux. And basically, every guest page is properly translated like an application. The guest OS looks like the application to the host OS. And we do paging all kinds of operations underneath as if those were applications to us. This actually allows us to completely overcommit memory. If you go back here, you can never overcommit memory beyond the minimum size that a guest operating system requires, otherwise it basically crashes. Here we can basically overcommit entire memory, this which allows us to run thousands or even 40,000 Linux servers on a single host OS. So, ballooning in the virtualized and hosted environments. Since the host OS has absolutely no idea what and how pages are used in the guest operating system, right? Whether they're unused, used, clear, dirty. It has to back up every page that it decides to swap out and basically put it on its own swap device, which is different if you look from Linux itself. Linux can see, hey, this is a read-only file map page. It's not dirty. I just throw it out, right? So no swapping required. So obviously, if you swap all the time, you have a higher I/O rate, and that's going to bite you as well, right? So deploying the ballooning in those virtualized host OS environments also makes sense because the ballooner tends to first evict the read-only data because it forces the OS, the guest OS, to do the dirty job. So let's look at the goods and bads and the uglies of both approaches. So if we just simply look at the guest ballooning can only get at pageable data. So if we look at non-pageable data, those are the kernel data structures and locked pages and so on, the ballooner simply cannot get to it. It cannot allocate those pages. So as a result, the only thing that we can recover, although that is a lot, are the pageable things. The advantage, of course, it's very simple to implement. I mean, a ballooner takes about 150 lines of code as a device driver in Linux. It's a very simple interface, any channel will do, and it can get rid of pages without doing I/O in the case when the pages are clean. The disadvantage, it's hard to implement on the host OS. As I said before, you have to do sampling, you have to figure out what the working set size is, so it's non-trivial to do. You always must find a somewhat optimum guest operating system size, which is difficult if you have many guest OSs. You know, before we showed these two curves, it's rather simple to find the intersection, but if you have tens and thousands of guest OSs, it's not very easy to find the optimum size for each of those. Second thing is, we have experience when you are too aggressive with your ballooner at the time when the operating system needs memory, it can run into the killer. Which is, you know, it ran out of memory, it cannot recover anymore, it cannot page anymore, and the system dies on you. So you have to always leave a certain slack around to make sure that you don't get into this situation. There is substantial overhead in actually invoking the ballooner. In order, first you have to, after you found out what the optimum sizes are, you have to invoke the ballooner, he has to run its reclaim daemon, he has to find the pages that are supposed to be evicted in the guest OS, then tell the host OS. The host OS can then tell the second or the receiving guest OS which pages to use. And so this obviously increases latency. You cannot overcommit the memory beyond the sum of all non-pageable guest memory, and it's non-scalable. It's obvious, once I have many, many guest OSs, every time I ping some of these guest OSs, I'm just going to get a few crumbs, a few pages here, a few pages there that I can consolidate and move to a guest operating system that has an instant need because of the bursty workload. So let's look at the good, the bad, and the ugly of the host paging. The good thing here is, you know, we can still deploy this the ballooner, and we can get to the non-pageable as well. The advantage here is the entire memory can be swapped, so we can achieve much higher overcommitments. And the second thing is that the host has a global view. right? So you can look at all the pages and decide what, for instance, the least recently used is and just yank it from the guest operating system. The disadvantage is you have, for instance, a dual swap problem. Let's suppose the host has swapped out a page because it was old, and now the Linux finally gets to its reclaim daemon and says, oh, I'm going to throw this page out. By the way, I have to swap it out. Now it's on a different swap device, so it has to be first brought in, and then it can be written back to the guest swap device. And that's obviously nonsense to do, right? The second disadvantage is always must preserve the guest page, because he has no idea what the state of those pages are. So what we want to do is we want to look at a technology that combines the best of both approaches and avoids the pitfalls. So that means allow host to swap non-pageable, but also allow the host to throw away guest pages or the pageable guest pages without invoking the guest. That means without invoking the ballooner, because that's what's going to cost. So why is that so important? Response time and throughput. So let me show you an example. What we have here is a synthetic benchmark, basically two curves that seem to follow each very tightly. So here we have a number of transactions, or the sequence number of transactions, and this is the time. The green dot is basically when the transaction arrived to the system. And the red dot, which basically is to the right on the same Y level, is the time when the transaction finally could start. So there might be transaction backlogs. So this is an artificial benchmark, which is based on queuing theory. So we're just basically trying to drive the inter-arrival time of transactions as small as possible, and therefore we get a higher throughput. And it looks pretty good. That means not too many delays. But when you look at the delay data, which is here in seconds, you see every so often that you have spikes. So for instance, certain transactions have to wait 14 seconds just to even be executed, which is absolutely unacceptable in modern transaction serving. So if you actually look a little bit deeper and just pick out a specific section, you know, I picked out 720. So I picked out the section around here. So where the spike is. So if you look why that happens, so you can see here, for instance, take this transactions here. So it arrived at this time, and it could only be executed at this point. And the reason for that is because the transaction before, which instantly executed at the time when it arrived, could not get to memory. And the blue dot that you see here is essentially the size of the operation, and it's not out of whack. You know, we only have, what, about 160,000 page operations that we're doing here. It's simply it lost its memory, and now one by one has to regain the pages that it has lost. That introduces wait times. Now, if you look, the wait times here try to easily make up. So it's basically every so often a transaction which goes to memory that has lost has to make up. But all the other transactions, as you can see in the previous thing, also suffer the delays. And you can see that again here. This curve is basically catching up with the green curve again. Then at some point you have another delay and so on. And so this every single time the question is, if I lost my memory, how quickly can I get it back? And our assumption is that when you have to run ballooners and so on, it adds to latency to get back that memory. So how do we approach this problem? Well, our idea was, well, why can't the host simply take the memory? Because it does not know what the status of the memory is. So let's give it to him. We're going to tell from the Linux to the host what the purpose of this page is and whether it's clean and whether it can be yanked or not. Okay? So by doing so, our main target is the identification of unused pages and non-dirty pages with a backing, which are particular read file caches and swap caches or swap entries. And then once we have given the information to the host, we allow the host to simply transparently steal the page from based on this usage information. And should the application or should the guest operating system later on touch that page again, we deliver a discard fault. And the discard fault should be basically understood like a page fault, right? We try to access the page, it's not anymore, I'm giving you a page fault back, and now, because you told me previously you can get rid of that page, I request the guest now to recreate the content of the page. He told me he can recreate it, okay? So how to implement this? It's actually quite simple. We have four guest pages, page states. It's very simple. Page can be stable, which means the contents cannot be recreated. Kernel pages are typically stable pages. They're unused. They're essentially in the buffer, in the body allocator. They're free, right? They're volatile. That means the page has useful content, like in a page cache and so on, or it's read mapped into user space. But we can lose the content at any time, and we can recreate it from its own, from our own backing devices and file systems. And potentially volatile is a special state of V, which we have a backing of the page, but we might have overwritten it. So if you have a write mapped file, if the page is dirty, then we have to make it stable later on. We can't just get rid of it. If it's not dirty at that point, we know we have a backing and we can yank it. If you go at the same point, so these are the guest stages. In the host, we have the typical pages is called resident. That means it's in memory. Preserved means it's somewhere on a backing store. That means swap, essentially. And it's zero. In most hypervised systems or virtualized systems, pages that have not been touched, although they are given to the operating system, are simply empty pages that have not been materialized. So if a page is marked as zero, it's essentially not materialized. So when you touch it the first time, you basically bring a backing page in the host. So what are the anticipated benefits? Well, the host memory management can be done more efficiently, so we can do more intelligent selection. If you told me a page is unused, why should I yank that before any other page? So we can yank an unused page. We can also reduce the reclaim overhead because we avoid page writes where possible, right? These are the clean pages, the guest can refetch them. The guest memory can be more efficient. We can avoid double paging because now I know that the page is not resident anymore. So why would I, in the Linux operating system, initiate a swap? I know it's already swapped out. I can reduce the memory footprint, which previously was done by the ballooner, simply by yanking from the host operating system. So I don't have to invoke the guest anymore. So the latency is reduced. And finally, we can replace two host I/O operations. That means a swap in, swap out, with one guest I/O operation. So I yank the page. When the page, when the guest touches it again, it fetches it from its own backing store. So I replace two I/O operations in the critical path by one I/O operation. And if in the case that the page was already discarded and Linux decides to reclaim it, that means just throw it away. There's no extra cost. Right? It's already thrown away. So overall, we reduce the latency to get to memory under constraint. And as I showed previously with these green-red curves and the delays that were shown, those are critical. If we can reduce those, they have overall system impact. So it's a very simple state machine. So we have the four guest states here and the three host states here. And the guest can only manipulate in this direction and the host can manipulate in this direction and this direction. So let's take an example. When you allocate a page, you get from unused into stable because it's going to be used in the kernel. At some point, you decide that you know I have created, a read map file and that the I/O has completed. It's now clean. I have a backing on the file system, so I make it volatile. At some point, the host decides I'm going to yank this page. So he just transparently, without knowledge by the guest, yanks the page and internally puts it into what we call a volatile zero state. So that means there's, the page is taken away. On the next touch, what will happen is we're going to get a discard fault. Okay. So in the discard exception, we're going to go that next. We're going to walk through how that's being resolved. While the page is in discard, the guest can decide, hey, I'm going to clear this page. Not a problem. So it's going to free it up and puts it back into UZ. If it's then allocated again, it's going to back into stable. And it's just transparent state transitions, which are very efficiently implemented. Okay. The only time really the hypervisor needs to get involved, the host OS, is when you touch a page that has been previously discarded. Then you have to bring it back, and there has to be some resolution being done. So let's take a look at how discard handling happens. So the host has thrown away a page, the guest or one application in the guest has touched the page, and so we essentially have a mapping here in the guest operating system that says, okay, I have a physical page that is mapped into various applications. So we have a page table entry, okay, and the discard fault comes in saying, you know, the host has not has no mapping for this anymore. You told me you can refetch it. The worst thing we can do is just simply replace the content of the page, because while the page is mapped, you simply cannot access it and override it from I/O because you have no consistent state there. So the very first thing we have to do is we need to cut all the translations. So we're basically walking from the struct page through the reverse mappings and basically killing all these page translations, right? When only the last reference of the page is in the page cache, then we can basically delete the page, rerun the instructions that caused the discard fault on XS, which then triggers a regular page fault, which brings in the page into, or the content into most likely a different page. So let's take a look at the Linux imperatives, or the implementation imperatives. So if you, what we need to do, we need to basically, or Linux always has to account for every page reference it takes. So every time you want to do something with a page, you've got to take a reference, which basically ensures that the reclaim daemon doesn't get in your way and yanks the page away while you're operating in it. So there's always one ref count for the page guess entry. There's one ref count for each established user mapping to that set page. And then there are transient ref counts, which are happening, for instance, during I/O. While the DMA is going on, obviously you cannot allow the reclaim agent to yank that page away. We also have one during copy on write. So now the question is, where we have introduced these states, when are we forcing these state transitions? So when do we make a page stable or unused? When, let's first look at the allocation and free. We simply say when before we allocate a page out of the body allocator, we make it stable because we don't know yet what is the usage of that page. In the same way, when a page is returned to the allocator, but we make it unused. Hot-cold pages, which are typically caches which sit in front of the body allocator to avoid the overhead of the body allocator, we just simply remain in stable because they are caches and we don't want to introduce too frequent invocations of our state transitions. We're going to see later it's quite expensive. Next thing is when to make stable. This must be a precise operation because if I miss a tick and I declare the page to be volatile, the page can be yanked by the hypervisor, and at which point Linux might get a page fault on, or a discard fault, which it simply cannot handle. It's in, for instance, in an non-interruptible state. So, by definition, we just say every time you take a reference, you will have to take a make the page stable. Period. There's no question. So then, when you those references are essentially taken in these functions, find get page, which is a page cache lookup, get user page, which basically ensures that pages are in content, and on the copy on write. Those are the three locations we need to take a reference and therefore make the page stable. Let's take a look. When can we make it volatile? So here the good news is we can cut ourselves some slack. We don't have to be precise, because if we miss a beat somewhere or we miss a page, it's unstable, we know that, so no harm will be done. Just the hypervisor will be forced to page it out for some additional overhead. But if you look where we essentially have to check for making a page volatile is in unlock, which is basically where we return a reference from find get page. Then in test clear page dirty, when we actually decided that a page has been rewritten to the swap device, it's now, or to the backing device, and it's now clean. So because it's clean, we have a backing, we can potentially declare it volatile. So next one is put page test zero, which is just simply a ref count decrement. And when we are adding a page to the reverse mapping, so we are taking a ref count. Now we really know what we're doing with the ref count. We established a mapping. That means we can check whether we can make it volatile or discardable in that sense. So if you essentially look, the it's a very simple check, which basically, in the first instance, essentially only looks at page flags, which can be basically two very simple operations on mappings. Then the page mapping, if there's no patch mapping, it's not file-backed or file-system-backed. By definition, we know that we're probably in erase conditions, so there's no backing. We cannot make this discardable. And if the map count and the difference of the ref counts is greater than an offset, typically as passed in as one, again, we cannot make it volatile because there somebody else took a ref count here. You know, we have one for the page cache, and then each for web for the mappings that have been established. Everything else is a transient, so somebody's mucking around with the page. So we got to leave that alone for now. But when that ref count is dropped, then we will catch it. So now we're going to talk about a couple of optimizations that we have. The first one is a minor fault optimization. Minor faults are extremely common, so every time you try to establish a mapping to a page, you first look it up in the page cache. If it's already there, then you simply establish the mapping. In this case, we would call find get page, which makes a page stable. We add it to the RMAP, which then checks for make volatile, and let's assume that the conditions are right, it makes it volatile. So we basically have two state transitions in a very short time period. To avoid the sequence, because it's so frequent, we simply say we allow the mapping of discarded pages without actually checking. What that basically means that we don't establish a ref count here. So in the find get pages, a simple version of that, and we require that in all the find get pages calls. Net effect is, of course, when you establish a mapping to a discarded page, you had a page fault, which is followed by a discard fault, which is, when that is resolved, followed by a regular page fault again, although those are not that frequent situations. Nevertheless, remember, three interrupts are substantially cheaper than doing I/O. So let's talk about a few race conditions that we encountered. So the first one is actually we need to check for whether something is discardable, which I showed you in the function before, and actually making it discardable or making it volatile, that needs to be atomic. If not, what can happen is you check for discardable, answer was yes, I can discard at this point, then the second thread or difference on a different CPU got a referent, made it stable, you decided to make it volatile after some time here, and now you access it and you get a discard fault. So the way we solve that is simply introduce the page flag. We store one of those remaining 12 flags and saying we're currently in a state change. So if you're currently in a state change, we just simply back off from making volatile. We know we're going to hit some race conditions, so we're just going to back out of it. And during the make stable phase, we simply hold the lock and the discardable has to wait until that. Okay. So the second race condition is concurrent discard fault. So that can lead to often discard fault. So imagine you have the same page mapped on two different processes, running on two different processes, and they both at the same time hit the page virtually. So what will happen, the first discard fault on the first CPU pops up, we're running the discard fault handler, cutting out all the links, and we essentially think that because there are no translations happening or established anymore, we can actually get rid of the page. Unfortunately, due to processor pipeline issues, scheduling issues of the virtual CPUs that are backing the guest OS, there might be still an orphaned discard fault stuck in the pipe. When that finally comes up, I have freed the page, it's used for somebody else, potentially already. If I run the discard fault handler, all hell breaks loose. So what we are essentially doing is we're marking the pages discarded so that when subsequent discard faults on the same page are coming, we are saying, okay, we already done all the break, we don't have to do anything anymore. But we have to make sure that all the CPUs have at least run so that the discard fault could have been delivered. So the way we do that is we basically just put the page into a discard list and wait until pages need to be reclaimed. So they're basically hanging around in some discard list, and when finally the reclaim daemon comes in, he runs a CPU barrier, and at that point we know there are no outstanding discard faults, and then basically freeze all the pages at once, which is also, we can batch those freeze at that point. I don't think I'm going to bore you with this, but this is basically just the life of a file page and the different transitions. You have like free, empty, when IOs are going on, it's just for our own reference of what kind of state transition you have to ensure at this point and which potential states you can be in. Just give you an appreciation of the thing. So here's a life cycle of an anonymous pages, which essentially brings you this bottom section from which is you have to have a swap device backing as well. And that also created quite some interesting race conditions that we just recently solved. So let's talk about Z-series. So this is all generic. So far we haven't done anything. The only thing that we need to really implement in architecture-specific code is make volatile, make stable, and those very low operations. Obviously, the guest state changes need to be fast, and we're going to see in a second why there are quite a lot of those happening. They have to be atomic, and they have to be conditional. So they have to be atomic, particularly when you remember we have guest and host states. If I don't have them on the, first, if I have them on the same word, then I can't implement the feature that the guest cannot modify the host bits, which absolutely cannot happen. If that happens, you basically compromise the entire machine. So essentially you need to implement them on separate words, but then, you know, how do you implement atomicity? So the second thing is, which I just mentioned, the shared data structure. And the final thing is, you definitely don't want to do a, what we call a sidebreak in this 390. In other operating systems, they probably would call that a hypervisor trap. You don't want to fall out of that. So if possible, you want to stay in the same context, that is the guest OS context. So we decided to bite the bullet and introduce an instruction in the Z series, which we call extract and set storage attribute. And essentially what we're giving is the address of, where we have it, okay, in R2 we have the absolute address of the target page, then the state that we want to enter, and we also receive the condition of what the old state of the page was, and then essentially some conditional operations in M3. So the ESSA is currently in, not in hardware, it's in millicode, but it still gives us the atomicity feature. The second thing is where are we going to store this, these extra 4 bits that we need for the guest and for the host state, and they actually maintained in the host translation table. You have to think of it like the access bit. You know, transparently, when you access a page, the access bit in your page table will be set. We're doing something very similar here. Based on that, today we have basically an overhead of an ESSA instruction of about 100 nanoseconds. If you emulate that, because it's part of the architecture, you have to be able to emulate it in your hypervisor. It's just the philosophy of IBM on those instructions, because it's a fully virtualizable architecture. Emulation is done through Hostwrap, and then you basically pay a nifty price, which is about tenfold, so about a microsecond for each transition. Why does it matter? Well, we ran a kernel compile on this emulated system, because that's where we can do counting of instructions, and we basically printed it out over time. And so we have essentially two kernel compiles. The first one goes from here to here, then we do a large search of a string in the kernel source code, and then we continue with a second compile. And as you can see, we have here about 50,000 state transitions per second that are happening in a kernel compile. And you can imagine why, because we have a lot of processes that start, establish mappings to code and so on. There's a lot of I/O going on when we're reading files and writing code or instructions back. So let's talk about these two curves. One is set unused, which basically means were freed, and the green one is set stable, which basically means they were allocated. Then we have the set stable if not discarded, which basically means I'm going through an IO operation. So a lot of IO is going on here on these pages. And surprisingly, set volatile is rather small, so we don't get a lot of volatile page identification. Let's take a look what that actually means, because I don't really care about the ESA instruction. I really care what are the pages that I can identify from underneath the host based on their state, because those I can yank away, right? So just because we had a low volatile page rate or set volatile page rate doesn't mean that you don't have a lot. So let's take a look. So the first one is, this is the total number of pages that we had in the system. The next one is basically the, it's hard to see here, so let's start out with the unused. So slowly the unused pages are being dropped. So that's because more and more code is being loaded into the page cache, right? At the same point, the potential, that's also the stable pages, which is the green curve here, goes up. And finally, the volatile pages, which is this curve, is essentially the page cache, so that we are loading. The interesting part is here, if you look at this large jump here, that's where we're doing the search, the deep search in the source tree for like a particular string, and that basically blows up our page cache, and that's so all of those are volatile. So if you can imagine you're underneath the host, you need to get quickly at pages. These are the number of pages that we can quickly and transparently get to. We know about that we can yank at all times, which is the thick red curve. The second example I want to show is SpecWeb 2005. We ran it on one CPU, 1 gigabyte, with a 512 JVM heap. So this emulates some form of enterprise business. And what you can see is they're quite hefty changes in the number of ESSA instructions. That means state changes are happening. So, of course, not readable. But if you look at a small section of this graph, you can see that actually quite rapid changes that are going on in terms of how many pages, how many state transitions are happening in the system. This would be, because this is quite unreadable here, basically ran a filter on it, which takes basically 30 samples and just does a simple moving average over it. And again, you see here, even with smoothing of the large curve, you can see quite rapid or quite heavy changes in the state transitions. Again, what we are interested in is, you know, can it identify the pages that are yankable or discardable from the host? And, you know, again, here we have the blue curve and the potential, the volatile curve together. So some of those is basically pages that we can yank. And here we have an example where actually you can see it doesn't change that much. So it's pretty reasonable, stable. And that's, if you look at the green curve, that's essentially your JVM. So these are mostly stable pages. The JVM heap, because it's anonymous memory, is not, or it's not discarded at this point, unless we back it. So let's do a scalability analysis. So we're, what we did, we have a benchmark. It's an Apache workload measurement something. It's just known as AWM. So it's an Apache workload. What we're trying to do is we have N clients connected to N servers. So they connect randomly and basically retrieve a random file on that server. And the server today is simply just 10 gigabytes of consisting of 1 megabyte files. And we're just yanking 1 megabyte files out of there. So we configured virtual guest memory for each guest to be 1.5 gigabytes. That means there's lots of page guests available. And ZVM was run with large host memory size. So here at the bottom, we have the host memory size, which is we're starting out with 65 gigabytes of memory. And because each, if you do the, I didn't say what N was. So N was 32. So there was sufficient memory available to host all of the guest operating system without having to do swapping or any of the partitioning issues. So as you can see, the performance of all the curves that we have is quite similar. So let's take a first look at the, which is the best one. Let's take a first look at the green one, which is called, we are simply relying on the old feature that was initially implemented under Z-Series, which was the simply host paging. You can see that host pages suffers quite quickly. That means if you just rely on paging itself, you're just basically doing too much I/O, and at some point there's absolutely no response anymore that is measurable. So you can basically in this example have an overcommitment of a factor of 8. The next thing we did was to say, okay, let's partition the system. We have 32 servers. And that means we're basically bringing successively the memory down of each of the servers while we're bringing down the memory of the host. So if you're taking example, you have 2 gigabyte divided by 32, it's like 68 megabyte or something like this for each server. And surprisingly, the size of this, the response time, the relative transaction time that we achieved in the system did not really drop, which basically told us we picked the wrong benchmark, because the working set size of each of these applications is, you know, can be squeezed to the bottom. That means the page cache is absolutely ineffective in this benchmark. The chance that you're hitting something in the page cache is rather limited. But, you know, that's what we picked, and that's what we're presenting here today. So now let's take a look at the ballooning techniques that we discussed early on. So you see that ballooning basically initially drops, but it's quite capable of carrying the system loads quite heavily. So when you have 32 servers running over 256 megabytes, you know, you have basically really squeezed the hell out of each of the guests, but you only have a relative performance drop of about 45%, which is quite amazing. But which I said before is the workload is quite optimal because I really can squeeze it, right? So the ballooners really squeeze it down to almost nothing so that the operating system doesn't die. So we bring it down to 64 megabytes, at which point the OS would, or the guest OS would die due to the killer, and then start paging underneath. So let's take a look how CMM2, which is our page hinting system, works. So initially, we also do just rely on the CMM2 factor. So there's no ballooning in place. There's no ballooning in place in this graph. So we can see that if we completely rely on this page hinting, that we do not beat the performance of ballooning in this particular case, although this is a favorable case for CMM1 or for the ballooning. So, however, if we say, okay, let's make the guest OS smaller, right, by definition, because that's what CMM1 already does, we can see that the smaller we make the guest OS, the more efficient CMM becomes, because we can yank the right pages and quickly yank the right pages. So you can see, if we size it down to 96 megabyte each of the guests, so that it leaves enough slack for the host OS to yank pages based on the state information, we can actually outperform CMM1 or the ballooning technique pretty much across the curve. Only at the very final end we are below the CMM1 case. So I think we are on the right curve here. I think we have a good technology, so we just need to figure out why we are not beating it. So the basic assumption that we made is a guest discard fault and a guest I/O operation is less expensive than two host I/O operations. Remember, rather than swapping, we're just discarding the page and receive the fault and do a guest I/O operation. Unfortunately, what we figured out, we didn't do our homework properly before we started out implementing the whole beast, is that on ZVM there's an entity, it's called XTOR, which is traditionally, from 15 years ago or 20 years ago, when memory was very, very small, there was an attached memory, which was not right on the bus. But the technology is still available in VM. It's still being employed, and think of it as a paging cache. So when VM decides to page something out, it puts it basically via memory operations in this extended memory area, at which point it's being picked up later on and thrown out to disk. So it's essentially a swap cache. So unfortunately, that means to us we have replaced two memory moves by one I/O, which by all means we know is not an efficient replacement. Nevertheless, as you can see before, we are actually beating a CMM1, and the reason for that is because CMM1 probably has to do too many relocation and ballooning requests. So the solution that we came up is we need to allow that pages are not yanked at the first instance, but they're yanked when they're falling out of the XTOR, when they're really falling out of memory. So what we extended the finite state machine that allows that we actually can preserve volatile pages. So VM decides, or the hypervisor decides, that it yanks the page, or it should store or swap the page, at which point it should decide, is it cheaper for me to do a memory move to XTOR, or should I put it on the swap space, at which point I should really discard the page. So this is ultimately the state diagram that we are pushing, and we need to fix this up. So the final solution that I think is the right solution is we need to combine the CMM1, which is the ballooning, and the CMM2. So we're using CMM1 in a more larger time scale, because we have seen that, once the workloads are reasonably stable in that section, that ballooning can be done with a small frequency. And we're going to still have to do the working side estimation. We have slow and delayed reactions. But if we leave some slack for CMM2 to operate, then, if this would be the curve that CMM1 would typically decide, the blue one, we just leave a little slack and then let the host underneath basically very rapidly steal pages and give pages in and out. And that's the final solution. The final extension, what we need to still put in, is the double paging avoidance. So here's a small picture which says, okay, when VM has actually paged something out, the guest still has a translation to its page, to the VM, to the host page. When finally the guest decides that it wants to page out this page because it runs its own LRU daemon, rather than incurring a double page fault, we're essentially also using the ESA instruction to simply swap the translation device, translation. So at which point we take the entry, which was stuck here, to the backing device and give it back to the guest, which then essentially can do the swap in later on itself, and we discard the page. So that's still on the thing. So what's the status? The Linux code is ready. It actually has been submitted many times or several times. So we are going to talk to Andrew about it, pick it up. Mostly it is architecture independent. The 390 code has been implemented. It's about, I think, 100 lines of assembler code. The ZVM support in its first instance is ready. The ESA instructions is officially part of the D9 architecture. So it will be supported here on. And the system supports about 100 guests under severe memory constraints, which I've shown before, 256 megabytes supporting 32 large guests, and it runs for days without any hiccup anymore. So I think we're pretty confident that the code is right. What we obviously have to do is more performance evaluation. The AWM that I showed you was a wrong benchmark, and I showed you previously these transactions with the delays based on queuing theory. That's actually the one that we want to use to really show that when we're pairing CMM1 with CMM2 versus just simple CMM1 versus simple CMM2 and so on, that literally you can get rid of these spikes in the transaction wait time, which basically kills you when you want to go and run the system. And obviously we have to fix this problem that we created with the XTOR that needs to be done in order to gain better performance on top of it.